Welcome to Imagine This Podcast, where we discuss, celebrate, and highlight all of the excellence and abundant arts and culture in Milwaukee.
We hope that after listening to the pod, you'll see and experience our city and the incredibly vibrant arts and culture community in a new way. I'm David Lee.
And I'm Mac Antigua. Here comes Imagine This. Here comes Imagine This. Here comes Imagine This Podcast. It's public domain, right? So I don't have to pay.
We don't have to pay, but are you trying to make up for the hot takes from last week about Christmas music?
I mean, to be totally authentic, I really don't like Christmas music, but I did turn it up to 10 just to like get that heel heat going, right? If life is pro wrestling, I figured I'd cut a heel promo and made my target Christmas music. So yeah, right.
So you're extending the bit at this point.
A little bit. Well, yeah, I'm acknowledging the reality of it, and it got feedback in the public. Not that we got like death threats or anything, but a couple of my friends tweeted me added me on Twitter, going, "Ooh, hat take, Mac," and I literally quoted like that's the one thing they got from the podcast. Mac, right. Mac hates at MacArthur31. Quote: Christmas music is trash. Like that was the pull quote that's on Twitter. So in that moment, I was like, "Uh-oh." You know, but it's a testament to my unpopularity that was the extent of that.
None of the other stuff made it. None of the other awesome conversation bits that you had with Carla Tia Swanson made it to the pull quote. It was that you hate Christmas music.
Yeah, Christmas music is trash. That's the pull quote. The other thing I hate it here.
I hate it here.
Right? the other thing that one of my friends also raised, he's like, well, that's fair, but do you realize that your constituency, which are musicians, make a pretty good sum?
Correct.
Doing Christmas gigs.
Correct. Right.
And I'm like, yeah, you're not wrong. I didn't really have a counter to that. I'm like, that's a good point. I'm not trying to ice that whole genre. Cause yeah, you're right. It does pay, you know, people do Christmas gigs. Well, not this year, but in general, right? Like, you know, it does help the artists, not necessarily like the one like musician, you know, like the one like recording artist that needs to fulfill the back end of the recording contract. So they record some sort of dumb Christmas covers album. I'm not looking.
Here we go again.
I'm not looking at Mariah Carey. I'm just saying. Okay. So anyways, I've been chastened and I'm contrite. So Merry Christmas, everybody. And think of me when you're singing Jingle Bells.
Well, you know what though? I mean, you're also burying the lead a little bit, right? Because you're also featured, you and the family are also featured in the Downtown Bids Holiday Lights commercial. Where you took on the Meisner technique of walking down a non-snowy Christmas night downtown.
So what David's referring to is that the Holiday Lights commercial, which is airing on WISN constantly, apparently, is a promo for Holiday Lights. And yes, my family is in it. When you say the word featured, that is a very much a generous definition of featured, actually. We are in it at second 19, and then we're off on second 19.5. It is literally leading glance of us wearing masks. Yes. Walking. That also took 20 minutes to film. Like we had to walk as a collection of four down a path several times.
Right.
And we couldn't get it right. We could not like, we had to stop and look at something and point, and it was a really difficult shoot.
That's why you go to acting school, Mac. That's why you got to take on the method technique.
Let me be on the record that I was fine. It's the rest of the cast. Had issues. So I'm fine. I'm a pro's pro. So, but yes, yeah, you're right, David. I am featured, our family is featured briefly on the Holiday Lights, and that was fun. Thanks to Gabe Yeager for inviting my family in. So
yeah, thanks to Gabe Yeager for also having me in the in their retail works Christmas storefront.
Yeah, I didn't want to bring that up because I didn't know how you felt about it.
No, I feel great. I feel great. I just, you know, if for anybody who's seen it, like my only input is I would never wear that color shoes, but that's just not my, you know, it wasn't.
Why is it right? That all the other, they feature sort of 30 Milwaukeeans, you know, in this sort of hand-drawn.
Yeah.
Stills of like holiday,
yeah,
which is kind of cool. It's like it's showing them interacting. So my question is, when I first saw it, I thought, oh my god, that is David Lee a bit, like kind of like if they Simpsonized you, Yeah. Right. There's a bit of a Simpsons vibe. So it's a character, not a caricature. It's just sort of like kind of in that style. But I thought it was interesting that everyone else was sort of wearing like holiday gear, like jackets and hats and gloves. And you were wearing like a suit, like it wasn't tan suit, but the way they drew it, I thought, why does David look like a low level Yakuza officer? Like, why does he look like one of the toughs in like Black Rain, you know, like ready to like ice the protagonist's wife to give him drive to move forward. Like, you look like you're miscast in some sort of Van Damme movie as like,
oh, that's funny. Well, yeah. You know, wearing a suit typically is my like my sort of like,
that's,
you know,
your brand.
How I prefer to dress when we're not working from home, right? So it was nice to see that like I got a window display actually with Judge Mosley. Well, the Shermans, and also on Wisconsin with Judge Mosley, and he's, you know, in his judge gear, right?
Judge
and
gear, like,
yeah, right. You know, what an honor, A, to be in a window with Judge Mosley, and then also B, like, we're wearing our work clothes, right? Like, this is totally normal.
Was that Judge Mosley, like, triptych? Was that sort of like him sentencing you because of the crimes?
Because I'm a member from Black Rain.
Exactly, right. Because that's a subtle Easter egg.
I am waving at him.
He's like, please, my lawyer's not here. Don't sentence me. So where's that located? That storefront is, I believe, Wisconsin Avenue.
Right? On Wisconsin Avenue, the Judge Mosley one's on Wisconsin Avenue. I walked by it the other day and took a little selfie with me and with cartoon me and cartoon Judge Mosley, because, you know, it's such a fun thing, right? And I think what a fun way to enliven some of the empty storefront windows that we have downtown.
So yeah, so thanks to. I guess thanks to the downtown bid for enrolling us in their marketing efforts.
In their holiday engagements.
To what is it? Was it bring back downtown? What's the phrase again? It's something
make
like
it
that.
Back.
Make it back. Make it back. MKE.
Back. Yeah. Back now that they know that you hate Christmas music, though, they might have to cut you out of that commercial.
Controversial. If you watch that commercial and there's just a black darkness and second 19 to 20, that's because the lobby got to them. And we're able to
big Christmas. Big Christmas got to them.
Excise me out of the commercial. The downtown bit had their sister soldier moment. Was able to disconnect me from, which is fair. I would disconnect me too. So that enough mirth aside, there's actually a lot of business going on. It's just because it's the holidays doesn't mean we don't have business. For example, we're 1 week in to our holiday artist relief fund, and so excited to say that our fundraising is up to $67,000. Which is really exciting. We're hoping to get to 100,000 by the end of the month. So that way we can get $500 grants to about 200 artists. And the applications are coming in. And so thanks to those that have shared the word. So that's happening.
Keep them coming.
Keep them coming.
The deadline is when, Mac?
Deadline to apply is Friday, December 11th. So the end of this week that you're listening. Please pass on to an artist who lives in Milwaukee County. And we set it up that it's not a long application to fill up. And it's really around supporting folks who've lost business, lost the ability to do their work because of COVID-19 or medical in general too. And as well as the fact that the service industry went down, which is a big part of the economy for a lot of artists in the county. So if you're a creative, you're an artist, and if you need some support this season, please apply. And we're hoping to satisfy as many requests as we can. So that's that.
And similarly, we've been sort of hinting at this for a while now, but if you are on our email lists or have been reading the Business Journal or anything else, you've heard by now that on Friday, the county, Imagine MKE and the county finally announced the $700,000 Milwaukee Cares for Arts and Culture program that will provide grants to arts and culture organizations operating in Milwaukee County that have been adversely affected by COVID-19. The grant program was announced on Friday. The application is on our website. You go to, I think, COVID-19 Resources, Milwaukee Cares for Arts and Culture, and you can apply for, if you are a 501c3 nonprofit arts and culture organization with a primary focus on the production and presentation of arts performances, education, or sort of arts development work, you can apply for a grant that will help you through, that'll help reimburse some of the expenses for the losses you've incurred over the last year. So that's incredibly exciting. And as you all may remember, when we had Supervisor Haas on the program a couple of weeks ago, this was the program that we were talking about that he helped to shepherd through the budget process, which is so exciting. So at this point, right, with the state having announced millions of dollars for arts and culture organizations, with the county now having followed suit with $700,000 worth of CARES Act funding for arts and culture organizations, we're still waiting for the city to take action. And I think from some of the things we've heard from the city that they can't stand up a program fast enough. I think what we're here to say is the county did it. And the county has looked to us to help them move that money quickly. So, you know, if you want to do it, I think it shows that we can do it and we can do it quickly in a way that is, following the outlines of the program, because these dollars have to be spent by, these dollars have to leave, right, our doors and the county's doors by 12/29, or they go back to DC.
So there you go. Milwaukee City, don't let that be an excuse that you can't move fast enough, because if the county can move pretty fast, I don't know what to tell you. So there we go. We just cut a mini promo there on them. Also, another opportunity, we have a call for artists, our partnership. If you remember, Ian Abson and Michael Hosted were on the pod a few months ago talking about Light the Hone, and it's happened. It's lit. And they're doing this exciting program in the coming year where they're partnering with nonprofits. They're featuring a different nonprofit a month, The Bridge, and lighting their colors of the nonprofit once a month. So they're focusing on different not-for-profit, but they're also utilizing the website for Light the Hone to feature artwork inspired by a not-for-profit. So they've partnered with us to identify artists. And not only the artists will create something that will be sold, they will get a cut of the proceeds as well as celebrating and putting a light on 11 different nonprofits in 2021. So that is also due December 11th. Go to imaginemke.org/shinealight. Shine a light and apply, because we want to make sure that of this really awesome opportunity of amplifying the message of a not-for-profit, but also using the bridge as a way to amplify the abundance of service and possibility that's here in Milwaukee.
You know, I'm noticing a couple patterns, right? That the artist
December 11th,
deadline is December 11th. The county, Milwaukee County Cares for Arts and Culture deadline is December 11th, and the deadline for the RFP for Shine a Light is December 11th. And the other crazy pattern I've noticed is that many of these, we've talked about three friends of the pod, Gabe Yeager, who got us in these holiday fun downtown bid projects.
Yep.
Abston and Hosted, friends of the pod, working with them on Shine a Light. And of course, Supervisor Haas, friend of the pod. It's funny, right? You come on the podcast and then suddenly work happens. It's like magic.
It's a pattern. It's a pattern. You want to get things done, come on the pod. I think that's the lesson. We're calling you out, Mandela Barnes. Anyway. We're listening. Listening to us. Come on.
When did the production aspect of our podcast become basically like the podcast version of professional wrestling, where we're just like doing bits and cutting promos?
It works. It works. So yeah, we're cutting promos, doing bits and cutting promos. So that's the other news. And then also, it sounds like there's a lot of things going on and you're not keeping up. That's not your fault. That's our fault. We got to do a better job of keeping you up to date. And we will be having a public event in a couple weeks, right, David? And you want to talk a little bit about that? That'll help people get aware of what's going on.
Yeah, so just really quickly, because we don't know a whole lot about it right now, so there's not a whole lot to share, but a great example of how the joyful abundance sort of gets enacted comes to life around our offices. You know, a couple months ago, we talked about the possibility of doing an annual event in November. And then it sort of got pushed back to December, and we sort of kept marinating on it. And then we had a call about it last week at a staff meeting or at a sort of a touch base meeting. And it appears we're going to be doing an annual event on December 18th, Friday, December 18th, around the lunchtime hour. It's going to be basically a streamed event that's going to look back on 2020. We're going to hopefully get to talk to some artists who our work has impacted. We're going to show some of our highlights from the last year, and then we're going to do a little bit of look forward to what 2021 will bring for us, and or at least to the best that we can imagine. And so please be on the lookout for an invite to that. We'd love to have you there, and we'd love to in whatever way we can, right, as we're being socially distant, celebrate a year that has been full of challenge and full of heartbreak, but also I think full of possibility and successes that we've been able to do for our sector.
Right on. And I think we'll be using some, you know, I think the technology, so you can watch it, you know, from a lot of different platforms.
Yeah.
So it's easier for you to get to, and it's open for all. It's not just for people that have, you know, that are on the mailing list or whatever. Yeah. We invite all of them to watch. So stay tuned for that. It's been an exciting year sort of establishing Imagine MKE as the key convener connector and amplifier for arts and culture. And that event's going to talk how we did that. And I'm excited to say what we're going to use that beacon for in 2021. Yeah. Right. And that's pretty exciting. So, so that's sort of the news from around the Imagine MKE. How about that? And shout out to Mel Allen. And we'll now pivot to why you tuned in, which is to listen to our guest this week, Sarah Eskridge. Sarah Eskridge is the executive director of Democracy Found, which we'll talk about their work, but it builds on the theme, right, of inclusive democracy and making sure everyone's voice is heard. And so she's going to talk about her work. But before she took on that role, a little bit about Sarah. She actually is an former elected official, was an alder for the city of Madison for a few years, and then also worked in health policy prior to that. And then is also a proud alum of the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Got a bunch of letters after her name. Very efficient. It was a very efficient set of years as got both the Master's of Public Health, Master's of Public Administration, as well as her BA there. So really excited to connect with Sarah Eskridge of Democracy Found after the break.
I call out so the angels hear me. There's one last time.
Sarah, welcome to the pod.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks. Welcome to our virtual palatial podcast estates here. Thanks for joining us today.
You are, I think, the second or third person who doesn't live in Milwaukee. And so we're always a little bit like edgy about like welcoming outsiders to our virtual Milwaukee space. But of the three, you are the closest to Milwaukee. So we had some New Yorkers on a couple of months ago. And then just last week, we had a Minnesotan on. So we're edging.
Coming back.
Yeah, we're coming back. We're coming back to...
Well, and all too often, Madison and Milwaukee, we think we're so different, but we sure have a lot to learn from each other and to collaborate on. So I'm glad that you're letting me into the Milwaukee space.
Because... Wow, that is a very savvy response, Sarah, already. reaching out to our Milwaukee audience. It's a shame I have to inform you, there are tariffs that Milwaukee imposes. So every third word, you have to drop like a dime in a slot. And that's kind of how it works with the, you know, the county's got to make money, Sarah, let's be real. So thanks for playing along.
Right, get a new sales tax, so I was going to try this way instead.
There it is. Wow, there landed. It is. Wow. Getting hot. There we go. There we go.
Politics so, early.
Politics, what do you mean? Politics early, politics often. That's why you're here, as we're really excited to have you, because in a lot of ways, right, our politics is sort of our collective story that we're creating together. And so really excited to have you here to talk about, on face level, you know, as the executive director of Democracy Found, and it's a public policy advocacy, you know, institute. And immediately the pocket protector is forming on my chest and the glasses are forming and hearing, oh, but really it's about the story, right? And about an important story that we all hold, what it means to self-govern and what it means to live together and govern together. So I'm excited you're here to delve into that. So let's tell us a story, Sarah, about a formative arts and cultural experience. Again, was it a book, a visual art piece you created, a performance you delivered or experienced? Would love to hear about it, but then also thinking about what resonates with you today and how it shows up in your practice.
Yeah, I appreciate this question because it made me think back to my grandmother. So I spent a lot of time growing up. She lived in the suburbs of Chicago. So I spent a lot
I got it. We got to do it.
Park Ridge.
Oh, what's up, Niles? What's up? What's up, Manny?
Sarah, you just walked into like the sub podcast.
Oh no, the trap.
So, yeah. Well, Mac grew up in the suburbs of Chicago.
So and I always so, got a shout out. Anytime there's a suburb, I got to, where are you at? Manny is home of the demons, Blue Demons. All right, go ahead, Carrots. You're visiting your grandma.
Visiting my grandmother. Yes. So I think part of the thing was, detour again. So I haven't spent as much time in Milwaukee growing up because as a Madisonian, I would always go to Chicago to visit my grandmother because she was in the suburbs. So like that was the big city that we went to was to go to Chicago. And she always was an art institute member and went to all these early bird dinners before concerts and we'd go see shows. I didn't appreciate it as a kid. I loved it in the moment, but I didn't appreciate the difference that it made for me in my life, I think, until I became a musician myself. So in high school, I played in this string quartet and I was the violist. So definitely the nerdy one. So the pocket protector was early.
I'm sorry, you said string quartet and you said the nerdy one. And I just sort of like, that's the whole group, right?
Obviously the violist is the nerdiest of the string quartet. Yes. But it was so formative because it was both a learning experience in that you were part of this small performance troupe. And if you didn't hold up your end of the bargain, there was no one else playing. It wasn't like being an orchestra where there was this whole, you know, ensemble with you or even string section, viola section. You're the only one. So you had to do your work and show up. And then it was an early job for me too. We played weddings and we played events. Mm. And so we would market ourselves. And it was a way to learn about that sort of teamwork and responsibility, and I think really affected my leadership and finding niches in fields and filling them and then monetizing them, frankly. So it was formative for me in that it was totally due to my grandmother feeding that and buying me my first viola and helping me pay for lessons and all of that. So credit to Grandma Merle for my arts and cultural experiences writ large, but specifically the one that resonated was being a part of that string quartet all through high school. So meaningful for me.
So how did you go from playing the string quartet in high school, playing weddings and sort of doing that thing to being a healthcare analyst, a health policy analyst post grad school?
Yeah. Well, it wasn't actually that good, David. So
you're playing weddings, right? I mean, that's
a
real thing.
But as a high schooler, right? I mean, these were not the weddings that were auditioning. These were the weddings that just wanted someone who could play Pachelbel's Canon as the bride was going down the aisle. And then, like, some background music.
You were paid in, like, Sundays and, like, all the garlic bread you could eat. That was pretty much it. It wasn't, like, cash.
It was not a high bar. So it was not going to be the future for me. I thought about playing in college and it's like, it's just, I'm not that good. So we got to find something else that can work out for me. And yet I think there is something about being a part of a group where you, as I mentioned, you have to hold up your end of the bargain. You're part of a team, you're showing up, you're doing your work that trained me for professional roles in general, no matter what they were going to be. And so it ended up that healthcare became an early passion for me from a policy perspective. Mm-hmm. I always knew that I wanted to be involved in politics and policymaking in some way because of my mother. So my grandmother was a musician, my mother was a politician. Mm-hmm. And it was a was because music was not going to be the future for me. Honestly, wasn't going to pay the bills.
You know, it's funny. I remember your story sort of reminds me of so I studied film in college, and I remember moving to New York thinking I was going to be an actor or a filmmaker or whatever, and then seeing like off Broadway shows, right? Like not even off Broadway, like basements in like, you know, apartment buildings. And seeing the talent on those stages and me being like, nope, I'm not going to make it. This isn't like, I'm good, but I'm not like, I don't have that kind of heart. Right. I don't have that kind of like hunger for doing that work. That was the first moment that I was like, oh, this life might not be for me. And then I stuck with it for another 10 years.
Well, I resonate with that. You're going to not believe it when I'm going to tell you later what I do now, because you're going to think, gosh, she's going to tell me she's scared of failure. And then she's going to tell me what we do and don't think you're going to fail now. But like, I was totally scared of failure.
Yeah.
And so I resonate with that seeing how good other people were and thinking, gosh, I'm never going to survive this field. These people are way too good. And I mean, that's why I picked the viola initially. All those violinists, that was super competitive. Everyone wanted to be a violinist because that is like the cool thing to do. And the violist, you can be really good comparatively pretty easily because the competition is not as stiff as in the violin section. So it's all about picking your battles too.
very savvy choices were made. But it also sounds like you just shared as a bit of a family business in terms of politics, right? You're sort of exposed to the nuance of it. It's not always campaign work, right? It's the gritty of like, what does it take to make laws? What does it take to hear from people who are advocating and lobbying on behalf of them and really parsing out, right? Yeah. And again, the implications on people that these things have. And so you also, in addition to being a healthcare policy analyst, you went in the family business, right? You ran for office as well as an alder person for Madison, Wisconsin.
Yeah. So one of my earliest bosses told me that if you're not in the kitchen, you're on the menu. So that has always stuck with me, that you better get in the kitchen and take care of things. And my mom was very, very much an example of that in being a community organizer, being on the school board, being the person who, simple stuff, like we were the yard sign house. Like people would drive by our house before going to vote to know who Sandy Eskridge was going to vote for, because that was an important signal.
Yeah.
And that... Right. I mean, that is the sort of validator that we in our communities, there are so many people like that in our communities that help engage others in the process. Mm-hmm. And that's how democracy happens fundamentally.
Yeah. And so, you've been elected, you've gone through it, and now you're out of it, right? You're out of that work. What do you think the story of it? When we talk about storytelling, you know, what would you say the story of democracy has evolved through that time? You know, like, right? Like, what might be the story for you, right? And again, how might that differ from other stories that we tell collectively as a society? Some of the stories I think of is like the West Wing. I'm going through the West Wing right now. I'm back on season two. I'm mowing through it. Or Mr. Smith Goes to Washington. You know, there's lots of sort of public narratives of what running, you know, what being in office means. I would just still love to hear sort of maybe some of the ways that aligned and maybe some of the ways that it separates for you the story of democracy.
Yeah, I think there's a necessary idealism in being in politics that you have to have as a driving force, because it's really hard in reality. It's not as simple as in the West Wing that they pull an all-nighter and negotiate the bill and count the votes, and then all of a sudden this major piece of legislation changing the country happens. Because sometimes the major piece of legislation that's purportedly going to change the country happens, and then you learned that, like, actually nothing happens until implementation happens. Mm. And all the details are in the next bucket of work. And you thought you just did all of the work, but guess what? It doesn't matter until you get the next step of the work.
Right? It's all about appropriations, right? Follow that, but right?
Follow the money. I just think there is something, you have to be a little bit idealistic and willing to make sausage, as they say about making policy. It's not pretty all the time. It's not, it's sometimes very, very ugly. And I think all too often, it just, right now, I see at the local level where I was, you know, elected and city council level, there's a lot of power for the saying is that the squeaky wheel gets the grease. And I think that is so true. And it can be both empowering and engaging and incredibly frustrating, because there's something inherently idealistic about the fact that if you show up, you get listened to and things change. But also, who has the power to show up? I mean, it takes a lot in local government right now to show up for your 3-minute public testimony on a piece of legislation. It's not easy. It's not something most people can do, considering all the other constraints on their life. So the people who are able to do that are a self-selected small group, sometimes not at all representative of the broader public. Mm. So I think that's a tension that comes out in our democracy for me as a theme in so many different ways. When you ask, how does it really work? Mm. Is that oftentimes we do have these small groups of people that are actually making the decisions and getting the things done, or making sure that nothing's getting done. Mm. It goes both ways, but that kind of misrepresentation that happens all too often, I would argue, in democracy and in government in reality, is something that is incredibly motivating for me personally, but a tension that we are striking at all levels of government, but I personally experienced it at the local level.
You also inspired me to think about, Sarah, real quick, I just want to throw in, what's the implication for social media? Right. How, you know, in terms of Facebook groups, Twitter bots, right? It's one thing to show up, but then the maybe amplification or over amplification, it really does distort who is the squeaky wheel that's authentically squeaking as opposed to being astroturf.
Reality? Yeah. What is truth? What are facts? What's reality? Who is really engaged in something? How do you act in a representative way?
Yeah.
It's a big question that our democracy asks of us in a representative form of government. Mm-hmm. And social media completely contorts that. And I think it is something that we don't have answers to yet, certainly.
You know, I've always sort of reflected on somewhere on the order of 15 years, right, in nonprofit government relations. And I remember, like, in the mid-2000s or so, out in California, out in Los Angeles, where I began my career in government relations, five or six calls on an issue would sway an issue for a state elected official, right? Like they would be hyper focused on that thing, and like they would do something about it. And now, like, that's changed, right? Because of exactly what you all have been talking about. I remember in 2017, 2018, and taking a lobby group to DC. And every time we get led back into, like a senator's office or something, I always like to peek down at the notebook to see what people are calling about and how many tick marks there are. I mean, there were like off the charts, like healthcare, off the charts, right, gun control. Right. And still, as you know, right, not a whole lot has gotten done, right? And so I think that's been, like, when you sort of, like, looping back to the idealism, right, of, like, I can imagine that you have all of these elected officials being elected to office wanting to do a thing, and then they hear their constituents saying that they want a thing, and then nothing happens over and over and over again. that's a pretty terrible story, right? That's a pretty terrible way of being. And I think, and so we're super glad that you're here to talk a little bit about the work that Democracy Found, because it feels like we're in a place where democracy has been lost, right? And so can you talk a little bit about the innovations that you're trying to push through here in Wisconsin, and how that's going to help us revitalize, right, the story of democracy that we tell?
Yeah, it's ultimately about two things: about getting results and accountability for getting results. And I think it responds to what you're saying, David, which is so often we know that there are so many things that we could do on whatever your issue is to improve the situation effectively in government. And yet nothing happens, even if 80, 90% of the public agrees that this is a common sense step to take. And so something is inherently wrong in the system when those are the results that we're getting. So that's what brings me back to the frustration around who's making and pushing decisions. Who are these elected officials accountable to? And what is that? Where is that causing the system to shut down so that we aren't getting results that actually the majority of constituents and people in the United States want? And so that gets to the problems that we're working on, which are specifically our partisan primary system and the fact that you can win with less than 50% of the vote. So let me just very quickly break down those two pieces. And I think the first piece is in some ways intuitive to people because we experience it all the time. When we go in for the general election and our vote, it's already predetermined who's going to win this election, because whoever made it out of the primary in each district, in whatever, right, the district is going to be a red district or a blue district. And so whoever made it through that Democratic primary or Republican primary is going to win. It's not competitive. Over 90% of our races for Congress are not competitive. That's crazy, when ultimately elections are supposed to be the accountability mechanism. Competition creates accountability. And so if you don't have any competition, how are you getting accountability? So that's the crux of the issue. And the thing that we're working on in Wisconsin, and each state gets to do this, that's, again, the benefit of our system, is that it's a federalist system where states set up election rules for federal elections. So
we found that the hard way.
The hard way in 2020, right?
About 2 weeks ago. Yeah, exactly.
I told people, like, what's one of the like side benefits of the 2020 election for this work? It's like, well, people didn't know. Guess what? We all, every municipality to some degree runs their election differently, right? There's a lot, all that administration is local. So beauty and messiness of our system makes it hard to hack, it is possible. So anyway, all to say, right, we can change these rules. There's nothing in our constitution that says we have to do elections in such a way that 8% of the population in the partisan primary decides who gets elected. We don't have to do that. So we can get rid of that party primary, which is what we're advocating for, make it so that the top five candidates advance to the general election, so that you have a full ideological spectrum of potential candidates to vote for in the district who are going to be broadly representative of that district, and then use a tool called ranked choice voting to get to the candidate who has the broadest support amongst the most people. So all that means is that you could go in and say, well, I really... I'm sure that David is the best candidate.
Yes, obviously.
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 But if I can't have him, Max, all right.
Yeah, I know this narrative, Sarah. I know this narrative. I'm all right. You're describing homecoming. This is homecoming every fall. I really want to go to David, but man, Max there. Max there. He's got flowers. He's got a limo. It should be a good time. He doesn't have a record. He doesn't have a record
of our high school lives, right?
Just, yeah, except David's rarely been number one option. But yeah, I'm in the convo. I'm an all-star, man. But yeah, I wish we had Final Five.
I mean, we all know how to do this, right? We go about our lives all the time knowing who our first choice is, knowing who our second choice is. So it's just confusing. It's confusing when you go in and you look at your options in elections and you feel like, I think for so many of us, you don't have any good choice to make. Mm-hmm. And that's fundamentally misrepresentative in a democracy. Mm-hmm. So it gets back to that piece where, I mean, as I was saying, right, we got this small group of people who are making all the decisions. And when they're so ideologically polarized from each other, mm-hmm. the result is gridlock because compromise is not an option. Mm-hmm. So all that common sense policymaking that I was spending a decade of my career trying to convince people that these were like things that we could do to improve our healthcare system. Like so many of your listeners, I'm sure know that this program is super successful. Why don't we scale it? Because we know it's making a difference in this community for this endeavor of whatever it is. We know that if government would shift funds to put into that, it would be have all this outsized impact on the economy, whatever it is. We know so many of these things, but because we aren't passing anything and because things aren't ideologically pure enough on either side, mm-hmm. we don't get to do some of the common sense stuff that is actually supposed to be the messiness of legislating and lawmaking. Mm-hmm. And our elections shouldn't be causing that to be the result that we're getting. So that's why we're focusing on that root cause problem mm-hmm. at Democracy Bound, even if many of us, I mean, our group is very bipartisan. We disagree on so many politicians and policy solutions, but the fact that we can come together and fundamentally agree that we need a system of government that's effective is pretty powerful. Mm.
You know, there always seems to be a ton of conversation around like, well, people want to change, right? How our democracy works. And so the thing that people always talk about is, well, we got to do something about term limits, right? Which sounds democratic, but you know, my personal view is that like, to your point, legislating is really hard. And if you find good legislators and find good policymakers, you want to keep them, right? Because right. you want the best people doing this hard work. And it feels like, you know, just hearing you talk about this, you know, we've talked about this a couple of times now, it never occurred to me that this is a reasonable solution to that problem, right? Because if you are a great legislator and you're continuing to deliver value back to your district, right, you can, it sort of solves the thing about like, well, let's just vote everybody out, right? Or let's just yep. limit these people who are all terrible anyways. You're actually widening the field for folks to actually have the competition for the best to rise.
And making it an interesting job for people who do want to do the job right. for the right reason.
Right.
I think so often many of us rationally look at running for public office. And even though we know that we need good public servants in a democracy in order for it to function, we think, oh my gosh, I would never want that job. That job looks terrible because I could get nothing done. I could get so much more done operating in this nonprofit or private sector role. Why would I go and serve in Washington, D.C., where I'm just going to participate in partisan infighting all the time? Mm-hmm. So let's put ourselves in a position where these jobs are actually attractive to the type of people that we want in them representing us. Mm-hmm. I think there's something, we don't talk about that element of this enough, but I think that's a powerful part.
Is that, this might be too hot for TV, but is that why you're no longer an elected official?
It is, it's not too hot for TV. But it's true that, so I was working at Deloitte doing health policy work in a full-time job because I had to pay my mortgage. And I was also serving on city council in Madison in a very busy district where I was working 30 hours a week on city council. It was not sustainable to do both of those things together for the long term. And so I had to choose and I found this great new opportunity. But looking up, it was like, okay, so the next option, if I wanted to go into politics, is to run for state office.
Sure.
And that means you've got to start playing the political game for real.
That means you have to start fundraising every day.
Exactly. And you got to be gung-ho with your team, right? And no compromise with the other. It just wasn't me. I'm too pragmatic for that approach in many ways, I think, and too interested, frankly, in the details of the policymaking and doing the sausage making that you still get to do at the local level in a powerful way. Sometimes there's so much beauty to local government and the things that you can actually get done. It's why I was interested in doing it originally, because after a decade in health policy and feeling like I was just pushing this huge boulder up the cliff without seeing any real results, I could get a street resurfaced and it was actually redone. And there was a stop sign up and there was a new piece of public art on the corner and all these very tangible results from local government that made it very fulfilling, but not sustainable.
But it's this conundrum, right? Because I think to learn how to be a really good legislator, that's where you learn the chops.
Absolutely.
Of like how, you know, how these things work. It's not like, as David said, you want to parachute people into a role that, you know, state rep, state senator, U.S. rep, U.S. I mean, it'd be good to have some experience with Robert's Rules of Order and understanding how a bill becomes a law. I mean, watch all the Schoolhouse Rock you want. It's not the same as grinding out committee meetings or grinding out, to your point, listening to a public comment and listening to what it is. And I personally, it really resonated when you talked about the amount of time. My wife is the head of the school board in Sherwood. So, and this year, the amount of, you know, it's challenging enough because, you know, our village is a very sort of highly demanding. It's a very demanding.
Yeah. I like
it's
to a great, call my district very engaged.
It's very engaged, super engaged. Now add a pandemic and now everybody's into it. Apparently everybody's Dr. Fauci. Apparently everybody's got to play. So to your point, gosh, now add the complexity of trying to serve. You know, and thankfully, you know, she's an academic. So there you go. Insert punchline there. Oh yeah, she's got time. She's got a little more flexible time. She's not working the line at the auto plant, right? To your point, there's certain folks who have to have a level of flexibility and agility to be able to deal with the constituent meetings and all these things. And again,
it self-selects our legislators too, right? We're supposed to be a representative democracy. And then we make these jobs so that only certain people have the privilege to serve in them.
Right.
Can you talk a little bit about states that have implemented Final Five voting?
Tell us the good news.
Yeah, tell us the good news.
Tell us where it's working. Tell us how it's crushing
here
it.
Here or elsewhere, right? Other places.
We'll take other planets. We'll take other solar systems.
So it's innovation. So it's new. We call it political innovation for a reason, because it is based on implementations of similar policies. The state of Maine has used ranked choice voting for their elections for the past two cycles for both state and federal elections.
Okay.
California, Washington state have opened up their primaries to be a top two primary.
These are on the coast. Let's get us to the middle. Yep. Get me to the middle of the country. Yep. These are far out of the way. Get me to the middle.
Minneapolis and St. Paul.
Minneapolis and St. Paul have used
ranked choice voting for decades in their municipal elections. So there are variations of the, and other municipalities all across the country have used ranked choice voting in local elections for years. Australia's used ranked choice voting or a method similar to it for centuries. All to say, we've learned from these experiments that are happening in other places and tried to take what's best in terms of the outcome that we're ultimately working towards, which is creating results and accountability in governing, and put together the system that's going to incentivize that outcome most directly. And so that's what gave us this combination of opening up the primary system and using ranked choice voting in the general election. And the state of Alaska, importantly, just voted to pass this exact set of reforms via ballot initiative on November 3rd. So it will be the first implementation of essentially the same system that we're talking about for Wisconsin in Alaska in 2022.
Wow.
So we're very excited to watch Alaska lead from their remote location, but but it's new. It is new and we admit that, but what we've got going is not working. So we need new, we need innovation.
At some point, every institution was new, right? At some point, right? Everything. So that's, you're like, get it on the ground floor of this action. And again, it's a prime time, right, Sarah? Because people want more from their government. They're so wishing
about
that. So,
well, and unfortunately, we've seen in this past year what the failures of the consequences of the failures of government in so many sectors. So, there was a demand for it even before because people were frustrated by the system. But I think especially in this year, we know that we can't keep doing things the way that we've been doing them.
So David, really quick recording message. I have folks that come in and help clean my house while we pay them. And now, of course, this is the time when they're coming through. Like, it's you would think we're landing 747 jets, like we're right here. I'm just sort of all the times, of all the time. So, David, should I just go on mute for this part?
No, you're good. I can't hear it.
Okay, I just want to make sure because I'm.
Yeah,
and I don't want to
hear it.
Yeah, okay. I just want to make sure.
You know, we're actually going to keep that in because I want our listeners to know that MacArthur Antigua has house cleaners.
No, hold on. I contract with a service every 2 weeks. I take care of the off weeks. I'm the guy wiping everything down.
We got to know our strengths and be willing to pay for the services that we, you know, how economies work, right?
Every 2 weeks, they come in for an hour and a half. They're great, but it just happened to be this hour. It just happened to be this. Anyway, so that's all.
And
they're
going
to come through. So I just want to make sure it doesn't interfere with our sound.
So, you know, you're on an arts and culture podcast. And so it behooves us to ask about the book, right, that Catherine Dale wrote with Michael Porter, the politics industry that that Democracy Found is sort of built around, right? So can you talk a little, talk about the work of Final Five Voting and Ranked Choice Voting as a pair. Can you talk a little bit more about the book, despite the fact that you didn't write it?
Well, I will say I was intimately involved in the writing of that book, and credit to authors everywhere because I will never write my own book. It seemed terrible just being involved in the process of that book being written. So, my bad.
Man. Everybody's got stuff happening today.
Okay, I don't feel so bad anymore.
I helped in writing that book, and it was hard. It's hard to put a book together, but it's also incredibly powerful because it delivers the message very well and with enough of the background and the theory and the analysis behind it. But also, importantly, it's not just a book of commentary, it's a book towards action. And that differentiates because it does leave you with, we have the power to fix this, and Final Five Voting is the key first mover from an elections perspective, because elections are ultimately supposed to be our check of accountability on democracy. So necessarily, that should be the first thing that we change if we want to get different results out of our democracy. And then there are other things that we can do, of course, that will make a difference in improving our democracy, or as they say in their subtitle, save our democracy. But the book it's a fantastic read, and it was an impressive endeavor to put together, and really years in the making, because it started with a 2017 report out of Harvard Business School that then ultimately became the book that was published just this year.
You know, we often say around here at Imagine MK that every system is perfectly designed to give you the result that you get, right? And so in some ways, the political polarization and the disenfranchisement of voters' true choices, right, are, I think, it's a feature, not a bug, right? And so, can you talk a little bit about how elected officials from both sides of the aisle are sort of taking to this sort of package of policy proposals?
Yeah. So excitingly, to go back to the book for a moment, the book was the foreword to the politics industry was co-authored by two sitting congresspeople, one of whom is Congressman Mike Gallagher, a Republican congressman from Green Bay, our congressman here in Wisconsin, and then his colleague, Congresswoman Chrissy Houlihan, a Democrat from Pennsylvania. And they came together to say that they're both veterans, they both served in the armed forces, and they serve together now on the Armed Services Committee. And their frustration in Congress that they served on this America team in the armed forces, and now in Congress, they're forced to serve on the red team or the blue team and not collaborate on anything. Mm-hmm. And that's not what they got into public service to do. And so I think our frustration about the inability to solve problems as citizens, of course, some of our elected officials are going to be similarly frustrated by that inability to solve problems. It's not the job that Mike will tell you. It's not the job that he ran for. It's not why he wanted to get into government and serve. And so he's a strong proponent here in Wisconsin of Final Five voting and passing this legislation at the state level so that he can go to Washington, D.C. under these electoral rules that free him up to serve his constituents better in the way that he wants to serve them, in a way that collaborates and delivers real results. And so I think, you know, he's such a great example at the congressional level. And then at the state level, where we need legislators to actually sponsor this legislation and move it forward, I've been so pleasantly surprised and impressed by the level of interest on both sides of the aisle from legislators here in the state. So our lead co-authors are Senator Dale Cuyenga from Brookfield, a Republican, and Representative Danny Reamer, a Democrat from Milwaukee, and complementing them with colleagues, again, on both sides of the aisle in both the Assembly and in the Senate, but putting together a really strong set of co-sponsors for when we introduce our legislation in January or early February, so that this legislation can't be dismissed by being some sort of Trojan horse for one side or the other, right? Because it's not. It's fundamentally systemic and will benefit everybody by benefiting our democracy. And so it's incumbent on us. And I think I've been, again, impressed by the level of interest from legislators in putting their names on that and really strongly working it amongst their colleagues to build the support. The number of It's all been Zoom meetings because we started our lobbying effort in March of 2020. But
good timing.
I could not believe that these state legislators are sitting on hour-long Zoom conversations talking about Final Five voting during a pandemic. That, if that doesn't tell you how interesting and how needed this is, you know, nothing will. They come in, a lot of them come in very skeptical and leave saying like, okay, I get it. I get why you want to do this. And I see what you're talking about. Someone told me that I don't suck as much as he thought I did. And I take that as a win. That's the first step, right?
Yeah.
And you keep working from there. So it's encouraging the level of support that we're getting from legislators for this change.
Awesome. Well, you know, in terms of change, David and I actually have this really unique ability to make our guests the arts and culture czar of Milwaukee. You're a little bit out of our jurisdiction. So it's kind of like, it's like, you know, it's not like 5G or 4G. It's kind of like a really bad signal. Like, so I can't do that for you, Madison. But you have such a powerful background in policy and you've been in the role. Really, really would love to hear from you. You know, that's a joke, the joke about our power. But the real part is we would love to hear from you what have been the policies that have been effective for Madison becoming a vibrant arts and culture community. Would love to hear like what you've witnessed and seen that has had real impact.
Yeah, I wish her title were czar, but Karen Wolf is the arts and culture czar of Madison, Wisconsin. And
They actually have one.
So that's why our powers doesn't work there. Like it gets blunted. Like
it should be her title. I think it's something like arts and culture administrator or something, but czar is much more appropriate for Karen. And I would say there is something so powerful about creating a role dedicated to the work of bringing arts and culture to a city, because then you have someone who's constantly advocating for it, right? We talked about earlier, squeaky wheel gets the grease. And so you've got to have someone who's in the room to say, hey, that sounds like a really good opportunity for public art. Or, hey, let's insert a poetry reading at the start of this meeting, whatever it might be, someone who can bring that perspective to the table so regularly, I found had such an impact on what Madison was able to do. Most specifically for me, and a specific policy actually, is that in all of our major street reconstructions, which it's infrastructure, we did a bunch of infrastructure in the 60s and now we're replacing it all, right? Yeah. So there's
just about that time
into infrastructure in cities right now. And so big projects, big capital projects, we're putting in a specific amount of funds for public art in those street reconstruction projects.
Yeah.
dedicated. And in the scale of the project, it's very small, right? It's very manageable. But doing that and putting the dedicated funds in brings a whole different level of engagement in the project as well. So when you talk about how to get the community involved, I couldn't believe, well, of course I could believe, it was way more interesting to come to a public meeting to talk about what sort of art you want at the plaza at the end of the street versus, you know, the piping and the street design and layout itself. And so it gets people involved in the local government process and then can feel very proud about this huge tax burdensome investment that they've made in a capital project, but seeing something that's so beautiful out of that, I think is really, really powerful. So props to Madison on that policy in particular, but we have a lot to learn from Milwaukee about murals. So I think from a policy perspective, that's the exchange I want Madison and Milwaukee to do.
You know,
we've got some bad policies about signs that prohibit murals in Madison. So we need to learn from Milwaukee.
I think what I got from your story is this notion of how art is an incredible bridge in a real, like, because again, these aren't people who normally would want to be in a conversation about their streets.
Right.
But hey, here's a way to get into this conversation that invites them to go, oh yeah, this is happening. And now feeling connected to that infrastructure, it's more than just a street. It's part of placemaking, right? It's part of being grounded into a place. So
without a doubt.
And it's super savvy, right? Because it doesn't take much in a way, right? But it adds up, right? That could be a significant amount of investment in your local arts, artists and doing that when you're doing something anyway, that's gonna happen. So we're cool.
Right.
So Sarah, you convinced me, let's make this final five thing happen. I'm on board. But what would it take for other, how can other folks find you to learn more about it and get excited about it?
Join us at www.democracyfound.org.
Okay.
And please sign up as a supporter. It sounds very simple, but this is the sort of work that by demonstrating that people actually care about it, again, legislators pay attention. And so we are at the point in our work where it's new, it's innovation, people haven't heard about it. We're trying to spread the word. And so venues like this are so phenomenal because hopefully an entire new audience is now seeing the connection of our political system and how it operates with what you care about actually getting done for our communities. And I think that's the power in connecting systemic policy change to hearts and minds and actually making things happen.
You picked the right one, Sarah. We are the 250th Arts and Culture podcast in the country.
In the country. So that means in Wisconsin, we're number one, right?
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So I think you know, your booker did a great job of getting you on the right platform. But in all seriousness, Sarah, thanks again for coming on the pod, but also thanks for your continued innovation. I'm sure it could be lonely out front, but I look forward to a time where our, you know, our grandchildren or maybe our children, you know, at least my children, mine are 13 and 15. So maybe it's going to take a little, they'll be a little bit older, but they're going to talk about how, what you're talking about is practical. And that's what you do as opposed to,
I hope when they go in and fill out their ballot, when they turn 18, they are filling out a competitive ranked choice ballot for that general election. And there's no eye of the needle partisan primary getting in their way.
Right, that they're voting for David 100%. Mac, maybe he's all right.
Nah, he's not.
I guess I would take him if I had to.
Yeah, shrug. I got to pick five, right? Because they give me like a Culver's gift card when I get out of here, right? I got to fill that out. But, thanks so much, Sarah.
Thank you guys so much. It was really fun.
So that was fun to talk to Sarah. It's the first time I've ever met Sarah, although it seems like Sarah's been in the world, our world, if you will, of civic engagement, of civic participation, as well as policy. So.
You know, she attended our first Road of Democracy event, the one that I hosted, and just sent a really nice note afterwards about how reinvigorating it was to be able to sort of come at the civics question through an arts lens. And I think that really goes to show that, like, the one we don't think about. I mean, we talked about it a little bit in the interview with her, right? But that there's this, there really is this overlap on civics, our shared story, public policy, and government, and shared government and representative democracy that I think we don't often talk about, right? We only often sort of look at the West Wing version and then whatever's on the news, but then sort of in a daily practice, right? Like when we engage in democracy and self-government through this artistic lens, it's so interrelated.
I'm hopeful. I from talking to her and listening to her journey, it was a reminder of how the nature of our self-government right now almost is very isolating. It's very lonely for people that do that work, right? Because just the nature of the workload is a lot, but also, you know, almost disconnected on some level because of just, it's a sense of that, right? It's a sense of disconnection. And I'm hopeful for how art and culture can help bridge.
Yeah.
You know, and again, I think our electeds would appreciate that, because again, I think it's a lot to put on electeds, you know, for them to carry all this stuff. How are we all collectively informed so that we could support our electeds to make the decisions that they need to make, right? But because again, that's the story we'll tell is, again, what we know is the theme of isolation doesn't end well, right? So right. If we isolate our civics to the quote unquote, those who have the job title, that's our day job, but it's gotta be all our jobs on some level to be paying attention and to be engaged and to matter. So that's,
well, I think her story about how, you know, development projects, right. People would come out to talk about the art part of it, but not the other sort of infrastructural parts of it. And so like, how did the arts sort of bring that kind of engagement to all parts of civics and public life? I think that has always been a goal of ours, right? To sort of make that connection between, and not only make that connection, but to help further integrate, drive the inspiration of arts and civic life, arts and culture and civic life. I think it's just such a good example.
And the final five voting, I think she's very clear to say, this is not the silver bullet. Rather, this is just a way to make sure people feel like their vote counts and that things aren't predetermined and predisposed in the primaries, but rather, and if the premise is if I show up and it matters, then that's a feedback loop, then I want to keep coming back, right? And I want to keep, you know, doing that. And I think that's anything that instills that sense of connection and hope we need more of. And so best, I'm glad she came to break it down, and I'm excited about supporting policies and supporting systems that allow one, to make it easier for people to have their voice heard, but also two, when their voice is heard, that it actually means something and it's not zero sum and it's not necessarily diminished because of where they might live.
We need to bring Sarah back on for part two, Electric Boogaloo, to talk about to talk about that other stuff.
Yeah, what are the other innovations that they're gonna hopefully do to help?
Well, I think I mean, these are really common sense reforms, right? And I think the way that they are going about it, and particularly with the way that Sarah is able to explain it in a way that is clear, understandable, and you can really wrap your mind around it. I think I'm very bullish on the work she's doing over at Democracy Found.
You know who else I'm bullish on?
Our listeners, 100%.
They're the best. Thank you, listener, for getting through another week with us. And be sure to rate this episode 5 stars or share a positive review. It really helps people find us. And let us know what you think at pod@imaginemke.org.
Make sure you hit us up on Twitter or MacArthur31 on Twitter.
Insta.
And Insta at imagine_MKE or Facebook at imaginemke. Mention the pod or at Mac on social media, and we will make you an imaginary friend, or in his case, a non-imaginary friend due to his Christmas music views. Make sure you tune into our the other podcasts in our podcast network, Arts Forward MKE with Lindsay Sheridan and Black Imagination with Kenita Hickman and Antoine Carter.
Don't forget, we're also got some visual shows on the Facebook with the Milwaukee Theater Alliance's You Got a Thing. We're also sponsoring that as well. So it's growing. The media empire is growing. Until then, we hope you stay healthy. and stay safe so that you can listen to us next Tuesday. Well, that makes you like a who's who in Milwaukee.
A local downtown. Milwaukee celebrity, right?
Like... Your local Milwaukee celeb. Now we can put that as evidence for why you should be on those lists.
Yeah, that's right.
Influential Asian lists.
Right. Look, get the Yakuza looking guy on your list, right? to reify bad stereotypes. At least the suit wasn't tan.
And then it, like, pull up your arm, there's a big tattoo, like sleeve. You got a cigarette coming out of your mouth and you're just firing off.
Firing off guns like Yosemite Sam.
Guns, yeah, just firing guns. It's like, why is there a 7-panel thing dedicated to David Lee's, you know, fighting Jean-Claude Van Damme? What's that about? That's weird.